Hi, good evening, and welcome to another episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of Israel's War Against Hamas. We're in the new framework of doing this twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, so it's great to have you, and thank you all for joining. This evening, we are with two of our senior fellows, Rachel Fish from Boston, the United States, the CEO of Boundless, and an expert on Israel diaspora relations and on what's happening in American Jewry, and our longtime panelist, Professor Gil Troy, historian and senior fellow at JPPI. Lots to talk about, obviously. Many different moving parts in the war as it continues on the ground in places like Khan Yunis and Sajaiya, and thinking about the day after, of course, for Israel, and we'll touch upon some of those issues, but also, obviously, we're still in the aftermath to some extent of the university's presidents, the Penn, MIT, and Harvard University presidents who testified before Congress last week, and the uproar that came after that. And then over the weekend, over, I guess it was Shabbat, was the resignation of Penn's president. She's the woman who had that smirk on her face, it seemed at least to those of us who were watching from afar, as she gave those answers to Congresswoman Stefanik at the congressional hearing. One of the people who was also at the hearing, but did not get any fire herself because she was not as controversial in her responses and her answers and her testimony, was Professor Pamela Nadel. Pamela is a long old friend, but Pamela is also the writer, the author of a book about American Jewish women. It's called America's Jewish Women. It was the 2019 National Jewish Book Award Prize. She's the head of the Jewish Studies Department at American University, used to be the chair of the Association of Jewish Studies across the United States. And I had the opportunity to catch up with Pamela yesterday and get her feedback, or, you know, her impressions of maybe a bit of what went wrong for the university presidents at the hearing that she was also at. You might see there's four women who are sitting at the table. She's the one with the orange curlyish hair a bit, for those who might want to look up and see who she was later, although you'll see her in a second on the video. But she's sitting at the table with university presidents. And it was also interesting to get Pamela's perspective on just this issue, which I feel, at least as an Israeli, don't fully understand why it was so difficult for these presidents of universities to just say straight out, yeah, this is abuse, this is harassment. And Pamela gave us that very dangerous word that has now become a dangerous word, context, to better understand what exactly happened there. So here's the interview that I did with Professor Pamela Nadel, and then we'll talk to our panelists, Rachel and Gil. Here we go. Pamela, it's great to have you with JPPI. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been, I know, quite the week ever since the hearing at the House of Representatives at Congress. You were there as well. But I'm curious to zoom out from that whole situation and what had happened there and talk with you more about the general state of anti-Semitism in the academic world, in academia. What can you tell us about this?
The first thing I'd like to say, well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's great to see you again. The first thing that I want to say is that it's been building for a long time, and that is not what people were focusing on in the hearing. Obviously, they were only focusing on since October 7th. And it's actually part of a long rise of anti-Semitism in the United States since 2016. And I want, just before we turn to the campus, I want to convey how dramatic a change that is, because the last person to write a really good book on the history of anti-Semitism, Leonard Dinnerstein. Leonard's book was published in 1994. And in 2012, and again at the beginning of 2016, he published an essay where he said that, looking at contemporary anti-Semitism, the plague of anti-Semitism, he said, quote, "Most American Jews don't see it, feel it, or fear it." And then he continued, quote, "Anti-Semitism is too minor an issue to disturb the daily lives of American Jews." And that statement, and
that was just 1994.
that, well, no, he said that in 2016, following up on what he wrote in 1994. I mean, it's astonishing, right?
Right.
So, and one of the things, and one of the things that happens in Congress is you submit written testimony, but you only get to say 5 minutes worth of your written testimony. So my written testimony went into this in much greater detail. And I talked about, it's just, we had just passed the fifth anniversary of the murders at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And maybe that's what Congress might remember, but Jews in America, we've got a new litany. We talk about Charlottesville, Poway, Jersey City, and Colleyville. And when I say those words, Jewish people in the United States know exactly what I'm talking about. Murder at synagogues and a kidnapping in a synagogue. So, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? We Orthodox, visibly Orthodox Jews on city streets are attacked. The U.S. State Department, there was a swastika. There's swastikas, you know, on dorms today. I live near something called the Bethesda Trolley Trail. And last year, vandals scrawled the words White Power 1488. I know 14 stands for we must secure the existence of our people and a future of white children. The last words of the White Supremacist Manifesto. And I know 88 stands for Heil Hitler. Most people won't really know that, but it was on top of a swastika, so they got the message. So it's important.
Even us ignorants would know what they're referring to.
Right.
We would get really, the anti-Semitic message. Yeah.
Right. It's really important to understand that anti-Semitism in the United States is coming from the right and from the left simultaneously. And so in terms of the campus, already during the first Intifada in October 2000, students at the University of Michigan were protesting a Hillel teach-in and yelling Israel is a fascist state. Same time at Rutgers University, Jewish students saw placards that said, called for the liquidation of the Jewish state. 2015 at UCLA, the judicial board rejected a candidate because she was involved with Jewish organizations. Same year, a pro-Palestinian group disrupted an academic event organized by the University of Texas's and Institute for Israel Studies, and the police had to intervene. We've had the BDS resolutions on campus. None of them have passed student governments, but they've been, you know, introduced for, you know, surely for a decade or more. And then there are entire areas of the academy, which as a faculty member also really, really concerned me, where the post-colonial narrative, the narrative that talks about the evils of settler colonialism and that views the world through a lens of oppression, either you're oppressed and therefore you need to be championed or you're an oppressor, there are entire areas of the academy that have embraced that. I was president of the Association for Jewish Studies between 2015 and 2017. We were already dealing with calls for boycott resolutions from other learned societies like the American Studies Association. So the point is, what's happening on campus now is a result of what was going on before.
You know, one of the things that comes out, this is probably the Israeli in me who doesn't necessarily understand the whole, even though I've spent time on college campuses and been there as a student as well, but still it's a foreign experience, I think, for a lot of Israelis. And we look at this whole discussion that goes on between what's free speech, what's not free speech, what can be said, what can't be said. And our feeling as an Israeli is like, what do you mean? Anything that sounds anti-Semitic, anything that's anti-Israel should be outlawed or banned, right? And obviously, the U.S. has a very different perspective on this with issues of freedom of speech. But I'm curious where you kind of how you see this whole question of where the line should be drawn when it comes to hate speech against Jews.
So obviously, calls for genocide, calls for the murder of the Jewish people, calls for the murder of Jews. That's anti-Semitic. There's no question. The issue for the campus, and you have to understand that on our campuses, Islamophobia is also a serious problem. Right. And the issue for our campuses is where, as you just said, where to draw the line. And I should remind you that the University of California, the entire system, I can't remember the year, but a number of years ago, tried to figure out where to draw the line in the sand and couldn't do it. So again, another example of people have been dealing with this for a long time. So the problem for the campuses, and I wish I could have been involved in briefing those presidents. I was briefed, by the way, and I think the people who briefed me on what to do did a much better job. But the issue is the slogans. So the slogans, Intifada Revolution, and From the River to the Sea, those are open to multiple interpretations, as frankly all slogans are, right? So the From the River to the Sea, there was the Wall Street Journal published an article this week about a very small sample, about 250 students, asking them which river and which sea. They didn't know. They couldn't name it. Right. And then they thought, OK, so it'll just mean, you know, like the Jewish state under Palestinian rule. But then when they understood what Hamas actually says in its charter, then all of a sudden they said, oh, well, we wouldn't support that. So the problem is that on their campuses, the slogans are being used and they couldn't say that they couldn't educate Congress as they needed to in because of the way that those hearings are conducted. They couldn't say that you need to understand that those slogans are not the same as saying gas the Jews.
Right. And those are two very different things. And I think it's Israelis look at From River to the Sea, and it's, you know, although I have to tell you that my kids who are Israeli, born here, were also saying to me, what river are they referring to? Because like the Jordan River here is not really a river in the sense that, you know, you would think of like the Hudson or for that matter. But they're like, do they mean the Kinneret or something at some point? Anyhow, there is a feeling though, and you're a prominent Jewish academic. You were the head of the Jewish Studies Association. You're at American University, the chair of the department. I'm sure you get a lot of Jewish students who come to you to consult with you and talk to you about just their general feeling of security. And you know, we mentioned the anti-Semitism. There are students who I know are feeling, and we've heard some of them have come forward and spoken, who feel that this is a dangerous moment for them. What can be done, do you think?
So the first thing is, obviously, I'm deeply, deeply concerned about how they feel and about their safety. And I don't know if you know, but I actually also testified in Congress in November, which is how I ended up in Congress in December, at the House Judiciary Committee hearing, where I was seated with an extraordinary young woman from Cornell University, Amanda Silverstein. And Amanda talked eloquently and in terrible pain, and I completely understand this, about what they had faced at Cornell, where a student called to murder all the students in the kosher dining hall and rape all the Jewish women. And of course, the other protests that are going on and the fear about being visibly Jewish, you know, wearing a Jewish star, wearing a kippah. And this is that I don't know what can be done. I mean, what it has to be done, and something that the president's clearly emphasized over and over on Tuesday, and it was true on my campus, is that what we do is we do everything we can to make sure that the spaces are safe. Mm-hmm. But what I want to remind people, because I don't think anybody else is thinking about this, I want you to think about who these students are. That these are the students, our seniors now, spent their freshman year sitting in their basements on Zoom going to college. They are the children of COVID. And nobody ever seems to understand that some of the anxieties and the fear that they are feeling comes out of that other experience. I think in the future, people are going to look at this moment and they're going to, you know, historians will look back and they'll understand that there were a number of crises that were going on and that what we're experiencing right now is part of a longer pattern of crisis.
At AU, at American University, you created a guide for anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. you know, speaking about, I was skimming through it. What is anti-Semitism? What does it mean? What are the acts? I mean, a lot of people, like you said before, don't even know what From River to the Sea is. They might not even know the things that they're saying or doing are anti-Semitic. How has that guide been effective, would you say, in educating, preventing, and combating?
I created the resource guide. I was the lead author with my colleagues on this resource guide to understand anti-Semitism for the American Jewish community, for the American community, American University community. And the answer is it's too soon to know. First of all, we didn't complete the guide. It didn't go up on our website until April, the very end of April last spring. As you know, academics only live within a semester system. So nobody has, nobody's doing anything about campus, certainly for the faculty in the summer. And it's just beginning to be shared widely. And I hope it will be useful. I'll tell you the real motivation behind creating it is that we have lots of Jewish advocacy organizations in the United States. The Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee are really, I would say, the two leaders in responding to anti-Semitism at the moment. But universities don't really like it when outside advocacy organizations come in and dictate to them and tell them what to do. And so given that we have so many resources, so many faculty who are knowledgeable about this subject, including my colleague Michael Brenner, who writes about German Jewish history and also Israeli history. And we felt that we needed to create this from inside the community so that it would be a resource for our administrators to use.
Finally, I mean, you're working on a book now on anti-Semitism, and that was the first whole part of this conversation. But I just want to ask one last question, because you wrote another fantastic book about the history of Jewish women in America, and kind of off topic a bit, but kind of connected, is because it's about women. unfortunately, just the whole way since we've seen the events of October, the attacks on October 7th and the allegations of rape and sexual assault, it took a long time for the UN women, for the media, for governments, and I'm guessing also probably a lot of academics to come around and recognize that there were some serious rape cases and instances of women, Israeli women, Jewish women who were raped and murdered or raped and kidnapped or just raped on October 7th. Why do you think that is? I mean, it's something that baffles me to an extent. Why was it so difficult for people to just recognize the simple suffering? I mean, that's nothing simple, but I mean, the fact that this happened and say, we can come out against it. Well, why does it have to be so difficult for people?
So first of all, I wouldn't even say allegations. I think that that what we now know is, I mean, it proves it, it's been proven horrific rape and torture of Israeli women. And I think it's just another example of the worldwide bias against the Jews and Israel that organizations and groups that would automatically condemn horrific rape and torture when it comes to Israeli women, their silence is absolutely, absolutely deafening. And again, I'm going to put it into context, a word that is now anathema for some after that hearing, but not anathema for me. So I think you know that my book was translated into Hebrew. It was published right. A year ago, September. And in Hanashim HaYehudiot Shel America, I talked about what happened at the UN conferences in the International Decade of Women from 1975 to 1985. And what people won't remember is that everybody knows, let me back up, everybody knows that in November of 1975, the United Nations passed the Zionism is Racism resolution. What people don't remember is that it was first passed at the Mexico Women's Conference in June and July of 1975. And so it is part of this long-standing isolation of the Jewish people and Israel and the constant blaming of them for everything, which really goes back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion and to the Middle Ages.
Interesting, that arc of history that just, is there, that thread that goes through. Pamela, I want to thank you so much for joining us here at JPPI, and happy Hanukkah, Hanukkah Sameach.
Gam lecha. Thanks, Hanukkah Sameach.
That was Pamela. I found that to be a very interesting and important perspective, and I guess context to an extent of everything that was going on. And Rachel, I thought we'd start with you for a moment. You work, I know with you're on some presidential task force with Brandeis, and you've obviously been in that combating anti-Semitism space for a long time, but focus very much on Israel education. I mean, when you think about what went wrong there, Right. And now, obviously, they were very much, was legalese speaking and very much kind of trying to stick to a type of talk, of speech that would not get anyone in trouble. But it did hit this raw nerve that I think is now, and you could tell us probably even more being on the ground in the U.S., but is really farther, much, much bigger and wider than just Israel or just the Jewish people now. It's become a much bigger issue.
I appreciate, you know, Pamela's presentation and her framework. I would challenge pieces of it if she were present, meaning I think this begins way before 2016, and she even alludes to that in terms of the discussion around decolonization and post-colonialist theory. I think that we don't understand the impact of Soviet ideology in terms of hard leftist ideology in the context of the ways in which anti-Zionism has become anti-Semitism. And people are very uncomfortable still in the Jewish community articulating that position. And Gil, that's something I think we need to be thinking a lot more about, because it has been a academic and political guise for a very long time to suggest that it's just mere criticism of Israeli policy. And we all know on this call, we all know in terms of your listeners, what it looks like to engage with serious critique of Israel, governmental, militarily, et cetera. But that is not the discourse that's been happening in many of these spaces. And also to suggest that it's only within the context, there's the word, of universities is also a bit absurd. Meaning, for sure, the universities were a lightning rod for this, but it has spread way beyond the university since that period of the 2000s, into media, both traditional and social, into politics, municipal, state, federal, into the conversations of certain business sectors, for sure, social justice movements within interfaith communities. I mean, it is so much bigger than just the discourse happening in the campus quad. So that's a piece of this, because that goes to your conversation, Yaakov, around, you know, this impacting many more than just those who we think are touched by this. The only other thing I'll add, you know, is that when it comes to the conversation about the campus and the way the discourse exists on campus, there are two paradigms. Those paradigms have to be addressed. One is the impact of diversity, equity, and inclusion as a paradigm, which utilizes this notion of race and power and oppressor. And that has not been something that the Jewish community has tackled in a significant way. And it's not a Jewish problem. It impacts many other communities beyond that. And so we need to think about the intellectual framework that needs to be put in this sort of overarching discussion. And it can't just be through a lens of the power and the oppressor and skin color. That's piece one. Piece two is that what each of these university presidents, and yes, you're right, they focused on the legalese and they got very bad legal advice, I would suggest, or counsel at the end of the day, is that for all of these presidents, they know they are the first to denounce, to condemn all types of hatred, even when it seems like it's this minor microaggression. This is the language that's used. So in terms of words that can no longer be used, in terms of pronouns that have to be used, because that's seen as an aggression if it's not used. And yet, when it comes to the physical safety of Jews, no, let alone actually creating a space that allows for heterodoxy and diverse intellectual perspectives that can be challenged, that is not part of this larger conversation. And each of these presidents had the ability to implement their own university speech policies, and they chose not to. And if you choose not to, this is where it can lead.
Gil, I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts to share, but I also want to—I'll just add one other element, which I'd like to hear. I mean, is this maybe the day of reckoning? And Rachel kind of spoke about this, that the university, the campus world, to an extent, and you spent many years on college campuses. Is this the day of reckoning that they need, not just for Israel, but for everything that has just gone crazy over there? I mean, you know, to a simple person like myself, the takeover of woke culture, I mean, you know, the microaggression, like there's just so many things that you can say this is, they've gone off the deep end. Maybe this is finally that moment that will be that wake up call.
Well, thank you. First of all, before I get to that, I do also want to respond to two things of Pamela. One is that when she was talking about that student, I forget her name, and her testimony, what we heard was empathy. And that's what was missing from the college presidents. And I'm sorry, I've heard that they were over-lawyered. I heard that they had the same legal team that prepared them. That's not about preparation. That's simply about what I heard from one of my colleagues, a valued colleague whom I've known for many years, was empathy. And that's what was missing. And on top of that, the smirk was the supercilious approach of every non-Trumpian to a Trumpian questioner. And there's a political dynamic there. And I think if we're going to unpack what happened, I agree with you, Rachel, that it goes way earlier than 2016. And you've been on the forefront of this when you were a Harvard student, when you were an undergraduate, heroically standing up to this insanity. But we also have to add two other pieces. You alluded to race. But let's also talk about it's not just COVID. These are the children of George Floyd. These are the children of a moment when we were told there was only one way for the right people to think. And the way the George Floyd moment was then interacted and intertwined with the Trump moment meant that there is really, after decades of watching universities becoming more and more orthodox and not heterodox, it exploded in 2020. And this was the ultimate expression of that. And the Jews have always been the one thrown under the bus in the universities. Now, the question really is, the question you're asking, Yaakov, is this a moment of Jews saying, wait, we've had enough? We're the biggest fools in history. For the last 20 years, we've been bankrupting ourselves, paying $70,000 a year when many of us can't afford that to send our kids to Harvard, Yale, Rutgers, AU, et cetera. For years, we've been saying our most important donations don't go to Israel, don't go to our synagogues, but go to these universities. And we haven't been asking follow-up questions about what's happening. And Jews have been particularly targeted. So it could be that this is just a revolt of the Jewish donors. That's what I fear. What I really need is to hear more and more of my non-Jewish friends, more and more of my non-Jewish colleagues saying, wait a minute, we looked at that picture of those three arrogant, condescending, very smart, very accomplished women who had lost their souls and said enough. And that's the real question. I've been saying for years now that anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem. It's a problem of the Jewish haters, the Jew haters, and it's a problem of the non-Jews. And we saw that. And that testimony, and we're seeing it in the university campuses. Who wants a university campus where on any issue, anybody can be harassed, can be bullied. You can have this kind of aggressive yelling and screaming at people who are simply trying to go to school or simply trying to take a class. And that's part of the reason why I don't want to squelch the haters. I want to give them free speech. I want everybody to see what this looks like when we allow hooliganism and this kind of orthodoxy to run the show. Now, here's the deeper issue. 500 Harvard faculty, I just saw in the New York Times 10 minutes ago, have already signed a petition in favor of President Gay. She knew who she was playing to. Yes, she wasn't playing to Bill Ackman and the few donors of conscience. She wasn't playing to the 2,000 members of the Harvard Jewish Alumni Association who no longer are on campus so much. She was playing to her faculty. And until we really deal with the deeper rot, which is the academic associations, where I cannot get tenure unless I am given a nasmacht, as we say, a kashrut stamp, an okay from colleagues who look at history, sociology, anthropology, particularly the writers in the humanities, as part of the revolution, and have changed the fundamental ideals behind academic society, we're in trouble. And so we have to start looking at the American Historical Association, at the American Studies Association, at all the associations. We have to start looking at hiring practices that go on in the universities. And we have to start by saying, wait a minute, this whole thing has to be unraveled. And the only way we can do that is actually by not just having a bunch of Jewish donors, but by having faculty of conscience, alumni of conscience, and students saying, this is not the university that I want.
I wonder, you know, I called a friend of mine who used to work in government here and the other day, and I said, you know, if you want to give a good Israel response to this, this is the moment for the Israeli universities, Tel Aviv University, Hebrew University, IDC, otherwise now known as Reichman, has been doing it for a bit of time, Bar Ilan University, to create now massive English-speaking tracks and programs and start to do massive outreach to American Jews, affiliated, unaffiliated, Orthodox, conservative, reform across the board, and bring them here, make it, you mentioned 70 grand a year that people are paying and can't even afford, make it attractive and competitive on the price. Obviously now might not be the best time to market it with rockets landing in Tel Aviv, but that will hopefully end soon and really start to pull those students away and bring them here. And, you know, because Israel's toyed with this idea over many years. I'm sure the two of you have had your brains poked on this issue. Do you even think is that something that would be attractive, Rachel, to American Jewish college students?
I think so. And it's not a new idea, as you're suggesting. There are some of us who have had this suggestion for quite a while. Hebrew University is also starting a program, a BA in the fall, a 3-year program through the Rothberg School, the international school. And as you said, Reichman's been doing it for quite a while. Shalem, interestingly, doesn't have a program, but this over winter break, they will be bringing a cohort of North American students in order to have a study tour. So I do think there's an opportunity. I also think we have to recognize that some of the aspects of the Israeli institutions of higher ed would need to adjust to have some liberal education, great books education, which is not necessarily the way in which the institutions are currently formed. But I do think this is a real conversation that is happening. I will also say in the same breath, I have talked to many, many parents who are in the process right now, who have seniors in high school who are in the application process, and it is not yet impacting the family's decisions in terms of where the students are applying. So there is something to be said about the seduction and draw of reputation that is not yet giving a real run for the money in terms of the particularism and the identity of Jewishness. So we have to recognize, at least in the context of America specifically, where there is such a desire to be associated and affiliated with many of these universities, and not even because of what they offer in terms of education and critical thinking skills, but quote unquote networking for professional services and professional opportunities down the road is still very seductive to many. And we have to figure out how that then is challenged, both in the ways Gil's suggesting, in order to actually revamp the institution so it does what it's supposed to do and pursue objective truth and hone critical thinking skills and have diverse perspectives, and also recognize that the American Jewish community doesn't yet fully understand both the severity of what's happening on campus, how deep that rot is, Gil, meaning firing a university president doesn't solve this problem. Getting rid of a board of trustees doesn't solve this problem. This is a much bigger issue. And again, it didn't begin October 8th, right? This has happened for decades and we didn't have our eye on the ball. And now in order to reclaim those spaces, it's going to take decades to do so.
If I can agree with you as always, but and see you and raise you. First of all, the most dangerous thing is that we get one or two university presidents to resign and then everybody say, oh, the Jews did it. And then
Jewish money did it.
Then the second dangerous thing is that they say, okay, well, let's just add Jews to DEI. And let's say, oh, Jews are also going to be a favorite group. And then what we have done is we haven't undone the rot, but we've actually only contributed to it. And we said, oh, we want our piece of the pie too. Don't call us privileged anymore. So, and indeed, you're absolutely right, Rachel. We need a revolution in American Jewish minds. The days of credentialism, of obsession with prestige, of every rabbi, every professor, every aunt, every uncle, every grandchild, a grandfather, seeing a kid and asking one question, where are you going to school, must end. We have to start asking them, how's your soul? We have to start asking, what are you thinking? We have to start asking, what kind of human being do you want to be? Not just what kind of money do you want to make? So that's one piece of it. Institutionally, I think you're right. We need to, but look, I'm going to get into a lot of trouble here, but we have two extraordinary Israeli institutions, the Weizmann Institute and the Technion, which have reputations that are worldwide and are in the world of science. The Israeli humanities and social sciences need to be built up, especially their English language facilities, but also the teaching ethos. It's not just about great books, but it's about really investing in the I-thou relationship on both sides that's sometimes missing in many Israeli institutions. So that's a long-term project. A second long-term project, which Natan Sharansky and I pushed a couple of years ago in Sapir, is simply, let's just try to have 1-year programs. let's see if we can at least have a gap year program where before you go into the rut we call Harvard, Rutgers, Yale, AU, you at least have a year of what I call Pilates, strengthening your soul and doing some great books and learning how to think critically and open-mindedly in a very prestige-oriented way and a very excellent-oriented way. And maybe that'll help solve things. And then we really have to start thinking about the universities. I think two things have to happen there. One, we're starting to see places like Yeshiva University, places like Washington University, places like University of Maryland, which have never been considered to be, and I'm playing the prestige game, I'm not talking about the quality of the institution or the educational experience, considered to be up there with Harvard, Yale, Princeton, can start attracting students and scholars to start changing the dynamic. That's number one. And number two, within these huge institutions, how do you fix Harvard? You're not. But if you created a great books program, if you created one corner university, which at least started to build an issue, and this is not conservative, right? You know, the New York Times had an article saying, oh, the conservatives are winning this argument. This is about good old-fashioned liberalism, liberal education, critical thought. And if we started to at least build institutes within each of these institutions that had top prestige, excellent scholars, but also that old-fashioned ethos of what you called heterodoxy, of open-mindedness, maybe then bit by bit, $50 million at a time, rather than $20 billion at a time, we could try to save this problem.
Fascinating and very interesting. And also, I was just thinking, as both of you are speaking, that this also has to do a lot with like placement, guidance counselors that they have at a lot of the Jewish schools.
Which, you know, Jewish schools, yeah.
Yeah, are still pushing for the NYU and the Columbias and all these schools. But by the way, just one point, Rachel, you were talking about the networking. People could join one of my classes from Harvard, the WhatsApp group, where there was just a petition put in the other day that asking everyone to sign about the war crimes that Israel is committing. And one of the other people there, who's also Jewish, wrote to me and said, you know, we should fight back. And I was already at the point, for what? Right? I mean, why do I even want to get into it? It's not going to go anywhere, and I'm just going to end up being really upset. So maybe just best to sometimes sit on the sidelines, because you're not always going to win with them. I want to thank Rachel Fish, Gil Troy, Pamela Nadel for joining us. And you can catch us on Thursday for another great session of JPPI's Inside Analysis of Israel's War Against Hamas. Have a good evening and happy Hanukkah.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.